dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Former UNSCOM weapons inspector Scott Ritter appeared with journalist Dar Jamail last month in Olympia, Washington, and stunned his audience by telling them that George Bush has signed off on plans to bomb Iran in June of 2005. Ritter also said the U.S. manipulated the results of the January 30th elections in Iraq. According to Mark Jensen, who reported on the event in Information Clearinghouse, the principal theme of Scott Ritter's talk was Americans' duty to protect the U.S. Constitution by taking action to bring an end to the illegal war in Iraq. But in passing, Ritter said plans for a June attack on Iran have been submitted to Bush and that he has approved them. The purported goal is the destruction of Iran's alleged program to develop nuclear weapons. But Ritter said neoconservatives in the administration also expected that the attack would set in motion a chain of events leading to regime change in the oil-rich nation of 70 million, a possibility Ritter regards with the greatest skepticism. The former Marine also said that the January 30th elections, which George Bush has called a turning point in the history of Iraq, a milestone in the advance of freedom, close quote, were not so free after all. Ritter said that U.S. authorities in Iraq had manipulated the results in order to reduce the percentage of the vote received by the United Iraqi Alliance from 56% to 48%, and that the source of the information was an official involved in the manipulation. Ritter also told his audience that although the peace movement failed to stop the war in Iraq, it had a chance to stop the expansion of the war to other nations like Iran and Syria. He held up the specter of a day when the Iraq War might be remembered as a relatively minor event that preceded an even greater conflagration. Meanwhile, all over this country, one can see lawn signs and car decals that say, "Support our troops." What does that mean? Is it code that really means support whatever Bush and Cheney decree? Does it mean support the commission of war crimes and genocide, which is what is going on in Iraq? Does it have anything whatsoever to do with the well-being of the individuals in the U.S. military who are expected to carry out the war plans of the government, losing life and limb if necessary? A growing number of those soldiers and their families are joining the anti-war movement, and they have asked the nation to protest with them in Fayetteville, North Carolina, home to Fort Bragg, one of the largest military bases in the U.S., on March 19th, the second-year anniversary of the Iraq invasion. This week on the program, we focus on the GI resistance movement. Lou Plummer of Fayetteville is one of the organizers of the upcoming Fayetteville demonstration. He spoke with Brian Russell of audioactivism.org.
What is the purpose of the March 19th rally?
Well, the purpose of it is really to hit home three different points. One of those is that real support for the troops means bring them home now, not bring them home at some point in the future when the government of our country suddenly becomes benevolent instead of malevolent. Our second point of unity is that we should have money for jobs and education, not for war and occupation. What people need to understand is that when they hear a supplemental appropriations bill for $100 billion for this war, that you're talking about the war costing almost $2 billion a week. The $335 million that got so much publicity for tsunami relief wouldn't last 2 days in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And then our third main point is that the world still says no to war. The United States doesn't, but I think when people begin to realize that, you know, with us living in a world community of people, it's not just what the United States wants. We're not going to rule the world forever like we do now. And the majority of the people in the world don't like this war.
So what's the significance of the date, March 19th?
March 19th is the second anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And it's the first anniversary of the first demonstration in Fayetteville that had any measurable size since the Vietnam War. One of the things that we're trying to establish is that the whole GI resistance movement has largely been written out of history. And by having military veterans like myself, military families at the forefront of the movement, that were reclaiming part of the heritage in Fayetteville that people really don't talk about that much.
So what are some things, if anything, that the average American can do to sort of affect change, you know, particularly the U.S. involvement in Iraq and also the prevention of other military strikes in other countries?
You know, I don't come from an activist background. When I was 18, I joined the same National Guard company that my grandfather and my father had joined. Did 6 years, and I was pretty apolitical like a lot of young people. And when I got out of the military, because I eventually went to work full-time for the National Guard, the job that I took following my military service was a job as a prison guard, you know, at a medium security prison here in North Carolina. The military didn't serve as a job training program for me, nor did it serve as some sort of college funding service. So, you know, I'd like to consider my experience pretty average for folks who come from, you know, working class families. And what happened to me is that I met people who were active in other social justice causes, who, you know, began to show me that, you know, if you speak with moral authority, and you're not afraid to speak truth, that people will listen to you. You know, I think it says a lot that for 3 decades in Fayetteville, there really wasn't any sort of social justice movement. And we're going to put thousands and thousands of people in the street on March 19th. There'll be media there from all over the world. And some of the things that we're seeing happening, we're beginning to have young people in the military question what exactly is going on. We're seeing recruitment numbers drop, and we're beginning to see resistance from within the military, both in the terms of rising AWOLs and desertions, and just simple challenges to military authority, like the National Guard soldier from Tennessee who challenged Donald Rumsfeld at the press conference.
At this point, how much mainstream media attention have you received for the event?
A tremendous amount.
Really?
Got emails today from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. There have been stories in, from earlier in February in the St. Louis newspapers as the National Peace Coalition United for Peace and Justice met. The different types of media that we've had in Fayetteville, actually it's been interesting that we've had at sometimes more international attention than domestic attention from the mainstream media. British Broadcasting, Australian Television, Japanese Television, Canadian Broadcasting, but also from the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and occasionally even the Fayetteville newspaper notices that we're there.
What are some of the things that they've asked you or other people involved with the march, and what are some of the things that they haven't asked that you wish you could tell people?
Well, one thing they almost always ask is, you know, why are you doing this in Fayetteville? Why would you have an anti-war demonstration in a military town? And, you know, and what I tell them is, you know, I can think of at least 50 reasons to have this demonstration in Fayetteville, and each one of those 50 reasons has a name, and each one of them has a tombstone, because each one of them was killed in Iraq, they're members of our community, and they're dead in a war based on lies. There are several organizations who are co-sponsors of this event, and several organizations which are having their first national meetings at the event. You know, Military Families Speak Out, which is composed of over 2,000 military families and has been around since 2003, is having its first national meeting. Iraq Veterans Against the War and its co-founder Mike Hoffman are going to be in town. And that group was formed in the summer of 2004 and this has the potential to actually double its membership. You know, there are 20,000 people in the Fayetteville community who have served in Iraq. And then unfortunately, the third group of folks who are going to be meeting in Fayetteville is a group called Gold Star Families for Peace. And these are families who've lost a loved one in the war in Iraq. So, you know, the magic number for me is 3, not 30,000 or 3 million. It's those three groups and the people that they represent that I want to try and focus attention on.
I just wanted to ask now about some of the consequences of the war in Iraq, especially for the people here in North Carolina. If you could elaborate on, you know, how that affects us for the people who aren't in Iraq or haven't been there.
Well, there are a number of consequences. You know, one thing folks need to stop and realize is that one out of every 5 soldiers in Iraq is from a North Carolina base, either from Fort Bragg, Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro, or Camp Lejeune. So that's 20% of the fighting force, including North Carolina National Guard, you know, which recently had its largest deployment since World War II. You know, the other measurable consequence to North Carolina are the number of fatalities. You know, as I said, there are over 50 from the Fayetteville area. Add in a few National Guardsmen and the dead from Camp Lejeune, and you're getting a number that's approaching 100. So those are, you know, personal consequences. And then there's the consequences to our community. You know, when the National Guard is mobilized, our communities lose school teachers and firefighters and police officers. And these are men and women like myself who joined the National Guard because we didn't want to be in the regular Army. We wanted to serve our state, to serve our communities. And rather than doing that, these people who are such an integral part of our communities are serving in a war for empire and oil half a world away, while here at home, you know, we feel their loss and their absence more so than we would if they were in the regular Army.
When we have the military rotation and some of these different members of the U.S. military return home, and also hopefully when the, you know, a war in Iraq ends, you know, and we can bring everybody home, you know, what are some of the challenges that we all, you know, face, you know, when they do come back?
Well, you know, for many people, they're going to face physical challenges. You know, I have a young Special Forces sergeant who lives on the street that I live in Fayetteville. And, you know, the first week of December, he was shot 3 times while on a mission in Baghdad. And I spoke to him last week at a meeting. He stood in the parking lot in near tears, you know, because the realization that he'll probably not be able to use his right arm again for the rest of his life. And this is a guy who's newly married and who has 2 small children from a previous marriage. So that's a consequence. And then the unseen consequence is the reality of post-traumatic stress disorder. A large percentage of returning military folks are going to have to deal with it. And the way I explain it is most of us go through our entire life never being really, truly scared. You know, we might be scared we're going to bounce a check or something, but I mean that gut level afraid you're going to die feeling. You know, in 6 years in the military and 8 years in the prison system, I had about 15 minutes where I had that kind of fear. And that's something that I think about on a daily basis pretty much. And to think that we're taking 17 and 18 year old young men and women and putting them in a situation where they have that kind of fear day after day after day for as much as a year to a year and a half, I think any reasonable person would expect there to be some psychological consequences of that service when they return home.
I've also heard of some discussion of concerns about domestic violence and the increase of that in different parts of North Carolina upon return of different service people. Have you heard any incidents about that or know anything about?
Yeah, I can tell you that Cumberland County, which is where Fayetteville is near Fort Bragg, consistently year after year has the highest rates of child abuse in North Carolina. You know, I can tell you about the 5 spousal murders that we had at Fort Bragg when the first wave of Special Forces troops returned home from Iraq. You know, I can tell you about the pressure within the military to not report incidents of domestic violence. You know, and these are all realities. Even the Pentagon's own studies admit that the rates of domestic violence are much higher in military communities than in non-military communities.
Got the feeling, especially after the elections went the way they did, that some of the energy behind the anti-war movement and other things has waned. Do you think that's true? And if so, why?
Well, I mean, I'm not an analyst, nor am I a spokesman for the anti-war movement. You know, I organize in Fayetteville here in North Carolina, And in my experience, I have never seen the amount of energy or interest or participation from as many groups as we have at this point. Maybe for some folks who are disconnected from this war and approach it in a analytical or political mode, there might be some discouragement. But for people who are actually connected to this, you know, I have a son in the military. So this is not something that I'm detached from. This is something that I think about pretty much on a daily basis. And for me, there's an incredible amount of energy out there because of some of the things that are happening within the military that we think the anti-war movement is helping to start. You know, I think we can look back to Vietnam, although, you know, Iraq is certainly not Vietnam, to look at the three things that ended the war in Vietnam. First thing, first and foremost, was the resistance of the Vietnamese people. And, you know, as we see daily, the Iraqi people are resisting occupation. The second thing that helped end the war in Vietnam was resistance within the U.S. military. I mean, it became an ineffective fighting force. And right now, with the drops in recruiting, the rise in AWOLs and desertions, and other forms of challenges from within the military, we see that increasing. And then the third point was, you know, the opposition of the people in the United States and around the world to the war in Vietnam. And it's, you know, it's my job, my calling, if you will, to keep this issue in front of people. You know, if you can take someone like me, who's a military veteran, a former prison guard, you know, a white Southern man who grew up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and persuade me to join the anti-war movement in my late 30s when I have a son in the military, I think we can persuade almost anyone.
Tell me more about Military Family Speak Out and how that came about.
Well, Military Family Speak Out was started by a family in Massachusetts. Charlie Richardson and his wife, Nancy Lesson, have a son, Joe, who was in the U.S. Marine Corps. And as the drumbeats for the war in Iraq began to sound, and Nancy and Charlie, like a lot of people who actually study the news and don't just listen to the sound bites, realized that the war was totally based on lies, and they became vocally outspoken about it. And what they did was they personalized it, because it is personal. And interest in this phenomenon of military families speaking out rather than, you know, blindly supporting the troops, when, you know, support the troops to most people means support the government. And they had a slightly different take on it. So they started talking to folks like me and to other military families. And, you know, they receive letters and emails pretty much on a daily basis. There are Military Families Speak Out organizations that have started in other countries. You know, I was privileged to go with Mike Hoffman from Iraq Veterans Against the War to England and Scotland in December. And while we were there, we met with British veterans, we met with British military families, including this phenomenal woman named Rose Gentle from Glasgow, Scotland, whose son Gordon was the last coalition soldier killed before autonomous government was ostensibly handed over to the Iraqi people, which we all know to be a farce. So it's not just an American movement, it's an international movement.
I'm assuming there are a lot of family members and people in the military, in and out of the military, who are afraid to speak out too strongly or maybe come to events. Do you spend much time with outreach to them and trying to support them and, you know, help them get involved?
Yeah, I mean, there's two different ways that you can be a military family member. Actually, there's more than two, but the two predominant ways are, can be a person like me who is a parent. You know, the military really has no control over me. The only thing they can do to intimidate me is threaten my son. But people who are military spouses, you know, whose livelihood is dependent on the military, whose medical care is dependent on the military, whose housing is dependent on the military, those are the folks that can be silenced. You know, during the initial invasion of Iraq, there were a group of military wives at Fort Stewart, Georgia, whose husbands were in the 3rd Infantry Division, who began to speak out. And got quite a bit of attention until, you know, a general officer at Fort Stewart called them all into a gymnasium at a fitness center with no media allowed and told them something that silenced them from that point to this point. You know, there's a whole lot of pressure to conform, to support the mission. You know, the military is, you know, basically, when you sign a military contract, you agree to be treated as a convicted felon for the next 8 years. You know, and even in my particular case, my son, Andrew Plummer, was a petty officer in the Navy, is not an activist, but he was home on leave, you know, in March of 2003 when the war started. And he came down to a peace vigil with me just to hang out with me, basically. But while he was there, a reporter approached me to ask some questions, and he turned to my son and asked him, you know, what do you think? And rather naively, my son said, well, you know, I'm in the military. And he gave him his name and his rank and the ship he was assigned to. And he goes, you know, I think this war is about oil, and I don't think our guys should be dying in Iraq. But, you know, I volunteered, and I'll do what they tell me to do. And for making those statements, and those statements only, those were the only things that were quoted in this Associated Press article, the government charged my son with disloyalty, a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and convicted and demoted him based on those three statements. Now, this is the same military and the same government that will let people like General Boykin disparage the religion of Islam, you know, and tout Christianity while in uniform, or the recent Marine general who was allowed to say that, you know, shooting people is fun. You know, when Donald Rumsfeld's asked about their statements, which are particularly egregious and offensive to people who we ought not to be offending, he said that they have a right to free speech. But, you know, a 19-year-old kid who says something, the war's about oil, that most people in the world agree with, is severely punished. There's something wrong with that picture.
People who have family members in the military, what would you tell them that they can do right now, if whether or not they share your opinions about this?
Well, I mean, the first group of people I'll talk to are the people who don't share my opinions. And, you know, one thing that you need to realize is that all the stereotypes that you've heard about peace activists and protesters your entire life are stereotypes and caricatures, and they're not true. There are not people within the peace movement, at least in this state, or who will be at Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, you know, later in March, who would call them, who would spit on you, who would call you names. You know, there are people who, for the large part, are military family members and veterans. And while they may not agree with this war, they're going to separate their feelings from the war from their feelings for the, you know, mostly working class men and women who are serving in the military. Now, for the folks in the military who do agree with me, let me be the first person to tell you that you do not have to go to Iraq. You can refuse. You come to this rally in March, you'll meet people like Camilo Mejia, who came home from duty in Iraq and refused to go back. He served less than a year in prison. He's gotten a tremendous amount of support from people within the movement. You know, you can meet people who supported Jeremy Hinsman, a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, who was given aid and assistance to flee to Canada, where he applied for status as a refugee on the basis that he's being forced to participate in an illegal war. You know, you can resist, and it won't ruin your life, and you will be an inspiration and a well-supported inspiration for hundreds, if not thousands, of people like you who think that this war is wrong and want to take a stand on conscience to help end it.
Lou Plummer of Bring Them Home Now, speaking in North Carolina with Brian Russell of AudioActivism.org. For more information about the march in Fayetteville or the GI resistance movement, visit on the web bringthemhomenow.org. bringthemhomenow.org. Events are also planned here in the Finger Lakes for March 19th, and I'll announce those after our next speaker, so you'll have about an hour to come up with something to write with. Jimmy Massey is a former Marine Staff Sergeant who served in Iraq and has become a peace activist as a result. Communities in the Central New York peace and counter-recruitment movement brought him to the area, and he spoke last Friday in Ithaca to students at Ithaca High School, then to the Cornell community, and in the evening to the general public. What you're about to hear is the latter of those talks. Jimmy Massey.
I'd like to thank y'all for coming out tonight. I'm sorry, my voice, I've been speaking nonstop since last Sunday when I arrived, so bear with me. I have to reach down and utilize that Marine voice. All right. Why did I join the Marines? I get asked that question a lot of times because they say, you know, Staff Sergeant, you joined the Marine Corps, you signed the contract, so why are you complaining? Well, at the time of when I joined the Marine Corps, I didn't understand how the economy worked. All I know is that I had ran out of money to go to college, and my mom, I grew up a single parent in a single, or I grew up in a single parent home. My father passed away. Life for us was tough. By the time I was 15 years old, I was already helping my mom to pay for the mortgage. So when it came time for me to graduate from high school, I went on to a community college. For those of you that have heard of Frank Lloyd Wright, my dream was to become the Frank Lloyd Wright of the automotive engineering community. I remember during spring break, my mom called me and she said, "Bubba, I've got some bad news." That was my nickname. She said, "Bubba, I've got some bad news. Rick has been laid off." This was my new stepfather. My mom finally remarried in my senior year of high school. She said, "Rick has been laid off. And there's nothing that the union can do about it right now. He was a boilermaker." She said, "You're going to have to cut next year out of your mind completely. You're going to have to work during the summertime." So I told myself, I said, I think this would be a perfect opportunity for me to take a sabbatical and travel around the South. I always had a love for Thomas Wolfe and Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn. So I decided to take this sabbatical and roam around the South. Well, I ended up in New Orleans. I took a job working offshore on an oil platform as a tool hand, and I discovered Bourbon Street. Shortly after I discovered Bourbon Street, I lost my job. So you can imagine a 19-year-old running loose or running wild on Bourbon Street away from home. Shortly after that, I lost my car. It broke down. Then I lost my apartment, or rather I was kicked out. So I found myself homeless with a whole lot of pride and not wanting to go home and be a failure. So I decided to take up residence in Lake Pontchartrain Park. I took up residence and I decided, well, the only way I can go from here is up. I got the classifieds and I was looking through and I found an employment ad that was near the area. On my way there, I was walking to the interview. I passed by a Marine recruiter who was pumping gas in his car. I made eye contact with him. He made eye contact with me. And I thought to myself, what better way to get lunch? So I walked up to the recruiter, and he said, "I saw you eyeballing me." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, are you ready to join the Marines?" I told him, "Not at this moment," because I was hungry. He said, "Well, let's go on over here to Burger King, get you something to eat." So we went over to Burger King, sat down, and he started discussing all the tangible benefits of joining the Marine Corps. See, but I didn't tell him that I had heard the sales pitch before. I had actually heard the sales pitch for the first time when I was 16 years old. I had a buddy of mine, a friend named Sean Zapalak. Sean Zapalak and I were pretty much cut from the same cloth. We both had a love for surfing. We surfed during the winter time in the Gulf of Mexico and during hurricane season. We were both athletic, loved to play golf. When Sean graduated from high school, he went into the Marine Corps. Sean didn't make it very long. He only made it for about 3 weeks in Marine Corps boot camp, and they kicked him out. To this day, I don't know why Sean was kicked out of the Marine Corps. He never talked about it. I could tell that it was a sensitive issue with him, so I didn't bring it up. But Sean sparked that curiosity, and I thought to myself, man, the Marine Corps must be pretty tough. So here I am, I'm talking with this recruiter, and he's telling me about all these great tangible benefits that I'm going to receive, monetary value, clothes, car, a health plan, a dental plan, and also the Montgomery GI Bill to help me so that I could go back to college. At one point, he even told me that I could be an automotive engineer in the Marine Corps. Boy, I was stupid. But I asked him, I said, well, Sarge, tell me something. What makes the Marine Corps so special? I said, what's the difference between you and the Air Force? I said, because, you know, my second choice would be the Air Force, because I heard that's a lot easier.
That's where I went. I had a good time, too.
Yeah, I believe.
Never saw the Oxford Corps.
I believe.
Shot down 16-1.
All right. I had a couple friends of mine that went into the Air Force. Stephen Grabowski, he went straight in out of high school. So I'm sitting there, and he's going over all these tangible benefits. And he said, listen, I'm going to be completely honest with you. There is no difference as far as the tangible benefits or monetary value of going into the Air Force or the Marine Corps. It's all the same. E1 in the Air Force gets paid the same as the E1 in the Marine Corps. But he told me, he said, if you want to be a man and you want some serious hardcore training, then you need to join the Marine Corps. And then he looked at me and he said, you know what? I don't think you had the self-discipline to join the Marine Corps. I looked at him and I said, are you challenging me? He said, hell yeah, I'm challenging you, son. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you mean, self-discipline? He said, look at you. You're 19 years old. You're living out on the streets. God knows where you've been. And you're coming to me for a free meal. He says, it doesn't look like you got any self-discipline in the world. And I looked at him, I said, you know what, you're exactly right. So I called my mom shortly after I got done talking to him. Collect. And I told her, I said, Mom, guess what, I got a new occupation. She said, Lord help me, what is it? I said, well, I'm going in the Marine Corps. All I heard was a phone drop. I'm sitting there on the other end, hello, hello. Finally, she picks up the receiver, and she said, boy, let me tell you something. She goes, there's going to be a Greyhound bus ticket waiting for you down at the bus station in New Orleans. And if you ain't on it, then don't come back home. So I knew my mom was pretty serious about this concern of me going into the Marine Corps. So I got on the bus and I hopped on down to Houston. The next morning, after convincing my mom that I wanted to be a Marine, she took me down to the recruiting station and she gave me her blessings. See, I didn't understand at the time, but I understand now the situation that I was in. See, we have a problem in America. We don't have to have the draft because our system drafts young men and women into the military on its own. We have what's called economic conscript, where we're forcing young men and women, don't matter what race you are, whether you're African American, Chicano, Asian, they want it all. And President Bush has made that quite evident by creating this new No Child Left Behind. Because now the government has full access to your children. You see, if you don't have the money to go to college, you don't have the economic means to support yourself after you graduate, then we got a plan for you in America. We're going to send you to Iraq. We're going to send you to Syria, or we're going to send you to Iran. So there I was, 20 years old, in Marine Corps boot camp, and I was in a world of hurt. I'll be honest with you. It was a culture shock. I remember the first time when I realized that I was in trouble, and I'm standing there, and I forgot to say, sir, at the end of the sentence. And the drill instructor immediately ran over to me in a Speedy Gonzales fashion and hit me in the stomach so fast, I didn't know what was going on. But I'll tell you what, I got with the program pretty fast, if you catch my drift. Needless to say, drill instructors didn't have any more problems with me after that. And there were plenty of other recruits that they made examples of. I continued on with my career in the Marine Corps because I got comfortable. And the reason that I got comfortable was because from a statement that my girlfriend's father made at that time when I was back in high school. I had a girlfriend. Well, her family was rich. They had a lot of money. I always felt inferior whenever I went over to the house because we were living in a little two-bedroom style ranch. They were living in a five-bedroom, $1.5 million home. So I felt a little inferior. And I remember sitting there, I just graduated from high school, and we were watching the first Desert Storm on the television. And he looked over at me and he said, "This is going to end the ghost of Vietnam." Now, it ain't hard to put two and two together and figure out that he was a Republican. So I got challenged again, challenging my manhood. 18 years old, my manhood got challenged a lot. So I got comfortable. And by my fourth year in the Marine Corps, I was already $20,000 in debt because I bought a car, had insurance. I was still paying my school loans off. So when it came time to re-up, I thought to myself, what better way to make a career? And I remember feeling proud because we did put the ghost of Vietnam behind us. We were in a new age, a new type of Marine Corps where we can hit lightning fast, where wars are won within a matter of days, not years. And I began to believe this propaganda. Then we started making a transition from kill a commie for your mommy to kill a haji for your mommy. But the transition was subtle because the Cold War had already ended, the wall had fell, and we needed a new enemy. I was in the infantry. I was in a specialty MOS. MOS is basically, it just means a job. I was in what's called a CAT platoon, Combined Anti-Armor Team, which consisted of machine gunners, scout snipers, and towed missilemen, tracked optically wire-guided missile system. That's what I went to Iraq as, a member of a CAT platoon. We'll get to that later on. So then I volunteered to become an instructor down at the Marine Corps boot camp. Because I thought to myself, I want to inflict that same torment that was done on me to other recruits. So I volunteered and I spent 2 years, 9 months down at Parris Island, South Carolina, training young men to become Marines. I was an infantry instructor. I taught the Crucible. For those of you that know about the Crucible, it's a 54-hour long evolution. It's the defining cumulative point where a Marine transforms from a nasty civilian into a Marine. And then at the end of it, they get what's called their EGA, or the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor. And then they're finally blessed as a full-fledged Marine. And they graduate and go on to their occupation school. So that was my job. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed inflicting torture and pain because it was done to me. When I got done with being an instructor down at Parris Island, I volunteered to go on recruiting duty because I had made friends with a Marine that spent 3 years out on recruiting And he told me, and he was a Desert Storm vet, he told me the hardest thing that he had ever done in his life was recruiting. He told me that it was harder than when he was in Desert Storm. There's an old saying in the Marine Corps, the closest thing to combat is being a Marine recruiter in peacetime. I didn't understand it. I just knew it was a tough job, and I love challenges. So I found myself at a recruiter school in San Diego, California, undergoing the process of becoming a United States Marine recruiter, and I finally graduated. I got to go and recruit in my hometown area, Waynesville, North Carolina. See, I had the best of both worlds growing up. During the summertime, my grandfather owned a dairy farm in Waynesville, North Carolina, and I go down to the dairy farm and work with him, feeding the calves, scraping the lot, milking the cows. And then during the winter, I was back in Pearland, Texas, going to school. So I was excited. I was getting a recruit in Western North Carolina, my home area. My first 9 months out on recruiting duty, was an evaluation. Because on your 9 months, they determine whether or not they want to keep you out on recruiting. And if you don't perform, then they get rid of you. On my 9th month, I was out in an area called Tri-County Community College in Murphy, North Carolina. And I met a young man by the name of Tim Queen. I was with my boss because he was showing me the ropes. He was showing me how to recruit. My boss is the one that actually found Tim at the community college. He came up to me and he said, Sergeant Massey, I want you to interview this young man. Well, when I went out to shake his hand, he started doing this. I looked over at my boss and I said, you got to be kidding me. This guy's not qualified to go into the Marine Corps. He looked at me and he pulled me off to the side. He grabbed me by my dress blues blouse. He pulled me off to the side. I was embarrassed because he did this in front of Tim. He got up in my face and he said, it's not your responsibility to determine who is qualified. It's your responsibility to find bodies to put in your beloved Corps, my beloved Corps. So I caught on real fast. So over the process of interviewing Tim, he told me that he wanted to be a Marine. About a week before he shipped to boot camp, his family called me up and said that they wanted to have a meeting with me down at the community college. The guidance counselor, Tim's guidance counselor, was there, and they began to proceed and tell me that they didn't felt Tim had what it took to be a Marine, that he was physically deformed. I assured them that Tim was going to be given every opportunity to become a United States Marine. They had nothing to worry about. Well, when Tim shipped to boot camp, the next morning, I got a phone call from Congressman Charles Taylor's office advising me that I was under a congressional investigation for fraudulent enlistment of Mr. Queen. I said, oh man, I'm in a world of hurt. I'm going to jail now. Then I turned on my computer, booted it up, started checking my emails, sitting there thinking to myself how I was going to spend my time in Leavenworth. And I click on an email from Parris Island, South Carolina, recruiting command, and there's an attachment. When I hit the attachment, there popped up a picture of Tim Queen standing behind a brick wall with Band-Aids over his eyebrows that had been penciled in with a magic marker. You see, Tim had felt the urge that night. He had a nightmare, and he thought that the drill instructors had told him to shave his eyebrows off. So Tim got up in the middle of the night and proceeded to shave off his eyebrows. And the drill instructors felt obliged to give him a new set of eyebrows while he was there. The bottom caption of the photo read, "Gentlemen, what are we doing?" And I thought to myself, what are we doing? See, I had grown a conscience at that point because I felt dirty. See, I had realized that I had betrayed my own people. Because Tim was a Western North Carolinian, a Tar Heel, and so was I. Tim was my blood, same as a brother. Doesn't have to be related. And I betrayed him. I sold him out to the lowest bidder. So Sunday afternoon, I sat down and I wrote a mission letter. I wrote a mission letter to my commanding officer, a man by the name of Major Bakley, and I explained to him in this mission letter how I was not going to recruit anymore unless it was ethical. Well, they didn't like that. About 2 days later, two career Marine recruiters came down and started making my life a living hell. But I made it through recruiting. Worst 3 years of my life, but I made it through. And I'm going to tell you right now, ladies and gentlemen, I lied, I cheated, I begged, I borrowed, and I stole for a contract. I did whatever it took to find that contract. Now what I'm going to do, since I talked to you about recruiting, is I'm going to explain to you some of the ways of how I manipulated the English language in order for me to find a contract. And this is the same manipulation that the recruiters are using in y'all's high schools on your kids. The first example that we're going to talk about is a drug abuse screening form. See, before a young man or woman can go down to MEPS, which is the Military Entrance Processing Center, they have to complete a drug abuse screening form. And what I would do before we sat down and filled that form out, I would look at the young man and I would say, listen, the only thing they know about you is what you and I put on this piece of paper. The Marine Corps does not have a secret spy camera that has been following you around all of your life and knows everything about you and every time you took a puff off of a marijuana cigarette. I'm going to tell you right now, if you've done drugs over 5 times, marijuana, you're going to be eliminated from about 90% of the jobs in the Marine Corps. You'll be lucky if I can get you into the infantry. Well, the drug abuse screening form, sorry, I lost my train of thought. He's cute. It's hard not to smile at that. So with this drug abuse screening form, I would ask the young man, before you answer yes to any of these questions, I want you to stop and tell me what it is that you're about to answer yes to. So, for example, I would say, LSD. He'd say, no. Or if he said, yes, then I would stop and I would say, wait a minute. If you've done hard drugs, if you've done things like heroin, LSD, cocaine, PCP, if you're a prescription drug abuser or anything like that, you ain't getting in the Marine Corps, son. And all these tangible benefits that we have talked about that you're going to get, the Montgomery GI Bill to go to college, you can hang it up. I ain't telling you to lie, however, then I look at him and I'd say, listen, if you repeat anything that I'm telling you to anybody else, I'll deny it. And who do you think they're going to believe, me or you? Then we'd move on to the medical screening form. I'll give you some examples how I manipulated that. Whenever we were going through the medical screening form, if, for example, if a young man had asthma, I would ask him if he had ever used an inhaler. If he said yes, I'd ask him how many times. If he said within a week, I told him he didn't have asthma. See, I'd explain to him that that doctor that gave him that diagnosis of asthma might be wrong. It's not up to him to decide. It's up to that Marine Corps processor, that medical processor down at MEPS to decide whether or not you have asthma. Because I'm telling you right now, if you put it down there, you ain't getting in. Then I learned that a couple $100 and a fifth of Crown Royal greases the skids at MEPS where they take their physical. That's how Tim Queen got in the Marine Corps, I later found out. So that's how it's done medically. Police involvement. I knew every district attorney in every county that I worked in. I knew all the sheriffs, I knew all the police, and I knew the congressmen. When I got off of my congressional investigation and I was cleared without any negligence, Congressman Charles Taylor felt so obliged that I did a good job that he sent me an autographed picture of himself. I still got it to this day as evidence. Well, I'll give you an example. Say a young man, he's out one Friday night, he's with his buddies. They get pulled over, and one of his buddies has a marijuana cigarette. Well, cops go search the car. It don't matter. They're going to get a possession charge. They can deny it all they want, but somebody's getting a possession charge. I can't put somebody in the Marine Corps with a possession charge, because generally, if they got a possession charge, that means that they're on unsupervised probation. So, over the course of lunch with the district attorney, I would explain how Cliff wants to go in the Marine Corps and how he wants to change his life and turn around and start doing good. So the district attorney would say, well, let me go have a talk with Judge Snow. See what I can do. Then I'm going to give you a call and you're going to go on down there to Mary at the clerk of court. And you run that police record check again, and you should be fine, and we'll get Cliff in. Now, what I would do to Cliff, he owes me. He's mine. I just bought his soul. So I would tell Cliff, listen, son, you falter on me, you backpedal, and just as quickly as you got that erased, a new one will appear. I only had that happen one time, and all it takes is a phone call to the sheriff, and he's going to find Cliff. He knows where they hang out on Friday night. He knows what they do, drinking beer, whatever. All the cops know where the kids hang out. And he's going to get him. So that's why I say I bought his soul. He belongs to me now. He's going into court. That's how I lied. That's how I manipulated the system. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a standard operating procedure in the Marine Corps. This is what was taught to me my first 9 months when I was on recruiting duty. See, but I started growing this conscience. And I couldn't sleep no more. I used to be able to sleep very well. When I got done with recruiting duty, I was pretty indifferent to the Marine Corps. I was pretty indifferent. But I kept telling myself, you know, that ain't the Marine Corps. Because I remember that first 8 years that I was in, we lived by a creed, we lived by a code. We live by those intangible benefits, honor, courage, commitment. This ain't the Marine Corps that I know. So I told myself, I'm going to give it a second try. I've got a lot of time invested in this big green machine. So I got over to Kuwait, and I still had all these indifferent feelings running through my mind, but I kept it hid. And told myself that recruiting duty was just in the past. I don't have to go through that no more. But little did I know, my humanity was going to be challenged. My ethics were going to be challenged again. See, because over a 48-hour period in the fall of Baghdad, I killed 30-plus innocent civilians, me as well as my platoon. We had pulled into an area called the Rashid Military Complex. When we pulled in, there was a Marine Abrams tank that was parked over onto the right side of the entrance to a compound. Up ahead, about 200 meters in front of us, was a group of demonstrators. There was approximately four. I went over to the tanker and I asked him what was going on. He was looking through his binos and he said, "Oh, Staff Sergeant, they're holding some demonstration." So satisfied that those demonstrators weren't going to cause any bodily harm or anything like that, I went back to my vehicle. The lieutenant's vehicle was up front. I went back to my vehicle, and I decided that I was hungry. I was going to open up my favorite MRE, Mexican MR or Mexican enchilada. Not more than as soon as I tore the package open, I heard a gunshot.